Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
What do you see? In the upper left corner is King Herod and his domain, the killing of the innocents. We see his throne, the symbol of sovereignty. We see his palaces of justice and other providing facade legitimation. We see his consiglieri, his advisors, his lawyers, his armed force, and we see his henchmen, his killers in action, and we see signs of manifest display of force. On the other side, you see Cosimo II de' Medici and his domain of the orphanage that you are in, the orphanage of the innocents here in Florence. His resources, his instruments of power are, in terms of hardware, the loggia outside, which you saw when you entered the building, the pillars, the kitchen, the dining room or refectory, and we are now in the refectory for the girls in the orphanage, in the so-called Salone Pochetti. The room for music instruction and the dormitory. We see his soft power, the woman who saves the child and enters the domain of the orphanage, the woman who oversees the nourishing and instruction of the children, the wet nurse who has her own child or children, but also breastfeeds the infant members of the orphanage, and the teacher. But there is a third domain, that of Mary and her son Jesus, a third dimension to the painting. Their resources are the killed children, the babies killed by King Herod, seen as martyrs by the painter Bernardino Pochetti, who have entered this idealized world in their innocence, and angels, characters who, because of their qualities, have been seen as worthy of this idealized kingdom. Her hand holds her robe, beckoning and offering protection, misericordia, to the innocent babies that are arriving. King Herod, Mary, and Jesus were contemporaries, but that is not the main dichotomy or dualism of the painting. Rather, the main dichotomy is between the domain of King Herod and the domain of the Grand Duke of Cosimo II. This is reinforced by the two separate stairways that lead up to the two different domains. The domain of King Herod is characterized by his fear of the rumored arrival of the king of the Judeans. He saw himself as the king of the Judeans and saw here a potential for a rival, a competitor. We see a display of force which relies on overt military power. He personifies state power in extension of Rome's power over Judea at the time. He projects sovereign power enthroned under a tabernacle, a symbol of heaven, a symbol of where the mandate was obtained from. We see the facade legitimation of the buildings, the monumental buildings, and jurists His domain required not only taxation, but also slaves to be maintained. On the other hand, is the domain of Cosimo II. It projects ownership in the Florentine cultured humanitarianism. It displays a youthful pride and openness, relying on, at that time, already 190 years of institutional practice of the orphanage. He personifies the Medici, the city, and the Grand Duchy. He projects the power of aspiration and cooperation. The domain, the orphanage, required the support of the Silk Guild, which founded and funded the orphanage, but with the protection of the Duke and the governing family of Florence. Above hovers the third timeless dimension, which interacts with the two temporal domains in two very different ways. For the domain and world of Cosimo II, it has an aspirational function. It sets the ideals, it sets the standards towards which one should, as individuals and communities, aspire. Whereas for the domain of Herod, it serves a judgmental function. There is the killing of the innocents and the moral judgment of that. And it is exactly this judgmental function which Nietzsche has reacted so strongly to in his thinking. And the title of my talk refers to the will to power, which comes from his writings. Nietzsche reacts to the judgmental function, to what he sees as a hidden agenda for revenge, and he reacts to the use of the free will. He says, whenever responsibilities have been sought, it was the instinct of revenge that sought. This instinct of revenge has so mastered mankind in the course of millennia that the whole of metaphysics, psychology, conception of history, but above all morality, is impregnated with it. As far as man has thought, he has introduced the bacillus of revenge into things. He has made even God ill with it. He has deprived existence in general of its innocence, namely, by tracing back every state of being thus, and thus to a will, an intention, a responsible act. The entire doctrine of the will, this most fateful falsification in psychology hitherto, was essentially invented for the sake of punishment. It was the social utility of punishment that guaranteed this concept its dignity, its power, its truth. The originators of this psychology, the psychology of will, are to be sought in the classes that administered the penal law, to which some of us, including myself, belong or have belonged. Above all, among the priests at the head of the oldest communality, they wanted to create for themselves a right to take revenge. They wanted to create a right for God to take revenge. To this end, man was conceived of as free. To this end, every action had to be conceived of as willed. The origin of every action as conscious. But these sentences refute the old psychology. And he says, judgment is our oldest belief, our most habitual holding true or holding untrue, an assertion or denial, a certainty that something is thus and not otherwise. Nietzsche moves on to link his thinking about the will to Schopenhauer's writings on Ding an sich, or in itself. He criticizes Schopenhauer and says that he did not raise the will to a sufficiently high level. He says that Schopenhauer erred, quote, what he calls will is a mere empty word. It is even less a question of a will to live, for life is merely a special case of the will to power. And again, Schopenhauer's interpretation of the in itself as will was an essential step, but he did not understand how to deify this will. He remained entangled in the moral Christian ideal. And here, note his anecdote, Nietzsche's anecdote, profound aversion to reposing once and for all in any one total view of the world. Fascination of the opposing point of view. Refusal to be deprived of the stimulus of the enigmatic. And this is exactly what Nietzsche does. He reacts to the traditional use of the notion of the will. He gives credit to Schopenhauer for seeing the in itself as will to life, but he criticizes Schopenhauer for not raising this impulse to a level of deity. So what is this deified will to power for Nietzsche? If the morality of thou shalt not lie is rejected, the sense for truth will have to legitimize itself before another tribunal as a means of the preservation of man, as will to power. That his will to live must be enhanced to an unconditional will to power and to overpower. So he goes beyond will to live, but bases the idea of will to power on the fundamental impulse or instinct of self-preservation of man. He refers to the degree of resistance that must be continually overcome in order to remain on top as the measure of freedom, whether for individuals or for societies. Freedom understood, that is, as positive power, as will to power. One must oppose tyrants to become a tyrant, that is, free. He places will to power on the platform of the will to war, to conquest, to revenge, and this is where it is becoming increasingly problematic. And he says that an inner will must be ascribed to it, to force, which I designate as will to power, that is, as an insatiable desire to manifest power, or as the employment and exercise of power, as a creative drive. And he goes further and links the criterion of truth to the enhancement of the feeling of power, and pleasure appears where there is the feeling of a power. So for Nietzsche's deified world, will to power is a means of preservation of man or will to life. It can be seen as a positive power of freedom in remaining on top, as will to power, war, conquest, revenge, as an insatiable desire to manifest power, as pleasure or as truth? Have we seen signs of an insatiable desire to manifest power in international criminal justice? We need to scrutinize the behavior of the good institutions of international criminal justice, here represented by the good institution of the orphanage in the fresco by Pochetti in this room. We need to analyze the leaders of the good institutions and the relations between them. As Bertrand Russell said, the fundamental concept in social science is power, in the same sense in which energy is the fundamental concept in physics. Like energy, power has many forms. We need to unmask the power the leaders wield. If you look in the lower right corner of the fresco of Pochetti, you see the little dog. This could be a beautiful mask, or it could hide an ugly mask, or behind that could be a harmless little dog. An insatiable desire to manifest power may be expressed in many ways. For you, I am the law. Imagine you are senior legal advisor in an international prosecution service, and when the prosecutor seeks to hire the fourth diplomat from the two countries that brought him into office, you gently point out that it is important to follow the rules for recruitment, and you are told, for you, I am the law. You may attend the meeting, but you will not say anything. Imagine you attend an internal meeting and you receive questions and you answer them to the best of your ability, and the chief prosecutor approaches you after the meeting and says, we have another meeting on Friday, you may attend, but you will not say anything. And imagine that this happens again and again to you. He is Australian, so he must be good. Imagine you hear this on a recruitment panel from the head of investigations. Or imagine you observe in the canteen of your international court or tribunal the president of the court meeting with the chef de cabinet every Thursday for several hours with piles of documents and obviously conducting business between the chambers, with the presidency and one of the organs before the court. So what is this? What are these four different anecdotes? How do they connect? Well, the first two express naked power, a power that is trying to assert itself. It concerns the relation between rule-based authority and personal power. It concerns the orchestration of meetings, reduction of independence, and undermination of the normal mechanisms of peer review. It concerns power within the international criminal jurisdictions. The second cluster concerns power that has become immune, that operates with a sense of entitlement. It is power short of self-awareness. It concerns power over states, of states, over the courts in recruitment and operation of courts. It concerns networks of individuals using state affiliation to further personal gain. The first part of this conference and project considers questions of power within international criminal jurisdictions, including issues of naked power, networks, professions, and civil common law. Part two considers representational, symbolic, and visual power. Part 3 concerns state power and the autonomy of the jurisdictions. And Part 4 considers other external power over the jurisdictions. State power over courts is the traditional approach to the subject matter we are faced with here. That is where the discussions and concerns for autonomy are located. Autonomy as in struggling in work on motions, briefs, judgments, in the context of cases, to carve out as large a space of autonomy as possible for the jurisdiction, for the court. In extension of that dimension is the power of other actors over international, other external actors over international criminal jurisdictions. But there is an equally important dimension of issues of power within the courts, including self-interested networks, instrumentalization of the civil common law divide, personal power, competition between professions, and bureaucratic domination. We need to move towards a topography of power in international criminal justice. We can see the world or international criminal justice as this topographical map from above. We can plot in the usual indicators of influence and power, such as geographical representation in the general service staff category. This we have linked here to a lake, a flat area at the lowest point in the terrain, because it is usually not problematic for the international criminal jurisdictions. One usually has good representation here. Likewise, in terms of the rights of members of assembly of states, parties, or other oversight bodies, they are equal. The principle of sovereign equality of states is respected. So again, this is not problematic. Likewise, background of registry staff. Usually this has not been a battleground. It has been a low point in the terrain with not such difficulty for the courts and tribunals to meet full transparency. The same with judges representing different state groups, because there are such strict rules on the election or appointment of judges, so it's hard not to achieve a proper representation there. Different when it comes to lead prosecutors. Here we have moved up in the terrain. The arrow points to a higher elevation on a hill, and likewise the background of section chiefs. We have gone even to a higher point in the terrain. Or background of senior trial attorneys, or examining lead witnesses. Who gets to examine the witnesses with the highest media potential? Or who gets to argue the top appellate issues? Here we are very high up in the topography towards the top of the landscape. And finally, who is lead counsel in important cases? In the Milosevic case, in the Karadzic case, in the cases against suspects, the names of whom we know. We can also see the topography in another way. On the right here, you see an island from above surrounded by water, but on the left, you see a cross profile of that island, showing exactly how the land rises, how, if you like, there is a concentration of power. Only by superimposing the different layers of indicators can we see the real topography of power within international criminal jurisdictions. The main imbalance, I submit, outside the ICC has been a bias in favor of Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States. More data should be extracted from international criminal jurisdictions and subjected to proper analysis to deconceal power concentration, we should find out more about the peaks that are in the area that have been encircled in this slide. By August 2002, from the start of the Yugoslav Tribunal, 85% of the section chiefs came from four countries, from Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States. 75% of the lawyers on general temporary assistance contracts came from the same four countries, and those contracts were characterized by the absence of competition for recruitment. And 50% of the regular lawyers who had gone through competition came from the same four countries. Let us move from Nietzsche's idea of an insatiable desire to manifest power to Russell's concept of naked power. And as we do that, we have a caveat that, as Russell said, we know that men love power, and, quote, those who achieve power love it more than most. And we also note Russell's statement that the success of insanity in literature, in philosophy, and in politics is one of the peculiarities of our age. And the successful form of insanity proceeds almost entirely from impulses towards power. This is a very strong quotation. And of course, it is put here with some hesitation, but it may even be relevant to aspects of international criminal justice. So what does naked power mean? Well, Russell equates it to the kind of power that involves no acquiescence on the part of the subject. The power of the state over loyal citizens is traditional, but its power over rebels is naked, wrote Russell. Power is naked when its subjects respect it solely because it is power and not for any other reason. The theory appropriate to naked power, he said, had been stated by Plato in the Republic in the sentence, quote, "My doctrine is that justice is simply the interest of the stronger. If human life is to be anything better than a dull misery, punctuated with moments of sharp horror, there must be as little naked power as possible," pleads Russell. The insatiable desire to manifest power causes the power wielder to become out of touch, and it lowers the intellectual level. Said Russell, an attitude of obedience, when it is exacted from subordinates, is inimical to intelligence. In a community in which men have to accept, at least outwardly, some obviously absurd doctrine, the best men must become either stupid or disaffected. There will be, in consequence, a lowering of the intellectual level, which must before long interfere with technical progress. It could even lead to the collapse or withdrawal of cases before international criminal jurisdictions. He continues, Russell, censorship and persecution, if they are severe, cause men to become out of touch with reality and ignorant or oblivious of facts which it is important to know. Since the holders of power are biased by their power impulses, he says, and continues, the amount of interference with freedom that conduces most to power will always be less than the governments are inclined to believe. Max Weber, in his Economy and Society, published in German in 1922 and in English in 1968, distinguishes between three types of legitimate domination. The first being legal authority, resting on a belief in the legality of enacted rules and the right of those elevated to authority under such rules to issue commands. The second category, he says, is traditional authority, and the third is charismatic authority, resting on devotion to an individual person and on the normative patterns or order ordained by him. It may not be such a good idea to mix elements of the category of charismatic authority into the domain of institutions of legal authority. For one, as Weber reminded us, it is held that the members of the organization, insofar as they obey a person in authority, do not owe this obedience to him as an individual, but to the impersonal order. And this was written 100 years ago. Johann Galtung, perhaps the founder of the discipline of peace research, introduced the concept of power channels, or types of power over others. He distinguished between ideological power, remunerative power, and punitive power. And we can distinguish between the perspective seen from states' parties and their power over international criminal justice and within the international criminal justice institutions. After entry into force, the ideological power rests perhaps more in the statute itself than with the state's parties. And if the leaders of the court are seen as tuned to the values of the statute, they may accrue ideological power. Otherwise, it may only be by their character, by their personality. And as regards remunerative power, the state's parties or UN General Assembly formally control the budget of the courts, but the latter have de facto influence, especially when it comes to technical discussions, because the discussions are so complex and so detailed that it is hard for states to have continuous expertise available on every issue. The leaders of the courts control the contracts and remuneration of the staff within the jurisdictions. When it comes to punitive power, the state powers have formal powers of appointment and removal, and through formalized oversight mechanisms. They have not been used very much, whereas individual states have, we must admit, de facto power over some court leaders. The leaders of the courts can sanction staff through their contracts, and as such exercise punitive power within the international criminal institutions to a vast extent. We can also apply Galtung's distinctions to different power cultures, if you like, in international criminal justice. And we can make a distinction between a culture of will to power and a culture that is more communicative. And here, if we look at ideological power, according to a culture of will to power, there is monopolized idea propagation. Ideas belong to persons, and some persons are to be seen as idea generators or idea propagators. The power wants that to be the perception. This constrains discourse participation. It limits the peer review function, and it creates a submissiveness to the power wielder. In a communicative culture, there is a balance of ideas, in a pluralistic, competitive idea market. The focus is on core responsibilities based on values underpinning the statute, the institutional mandate. Power may be seen as a servant of justice, and self-respect on the part of staff is encouraged. If we consider remunerative power in a culture of will to power, there is rewarding of personal loyalty and power consolidation. There is privileged access, deputization, protection against normal peer mechanisms, favors in assignment of cases and witnesses are seen. Fringe benefits such as conference participation, etc., are used. The dependency is central to ensure dominance. Whereas in a communicative culture, equality in all forms of remuneration is the aspiration. Credit goes to where it belongs. There is no fear of subordinate stars arising and shining. There is strong emphasis on independence. There are incentive structures, including being named in innovative work that you have actually done. And as regard punitive power, in a culture of will to power, subordinates are often forced to comply. They are threatened with punishment, or they are actually punished. There is intimidation, and one presupposes fear in the culture. Whereas in the communicative culture, there is performance and merit-based management. Accountability for weak performance and negligence, there is a proper reporting system that can listen to the organization, and fearlessness is encouraged. The ideological power of international criminal justice can also be seen as a priestly power. Russell referred to an organization which has ideal ends and therefore an excuse for love of power. A reputation for superior virtue is dangerous for such an organization and is sure in the long run to produce a superiority only in unscrupulous ruthlessness. All this is inevitable whenever superior virtue is used as a means of winning tyrannical power. And referring to religious institutions in the context of which Russell uses the term priestly power, he says that it is the fate of most such institutions sooner or later to be used by bold men for secular purposes and thereby to forfeit the reverence upon which their power depends. And he continues, emboldened by the respect which it inspires traditional power, it becomes careless as regards the general approval which it believes that it cannot ever lose. By sloth, folly, or cruelty, it gradually forces men to become skeptical of its claims to divine authority. Since these claims have no better source than habit, criticism, once aroused, easily disposes of them. And he says, and he reminds us, a government without psychological authority must be a tyranny. And the parallel can be drawn to other public institutions than a government. Galton writes on autonomy or power over oneself. He says that very often the stronger the power exercised, the stronger the immunization. Power has to be subtle to operate, so subtle that it does not stimulate counterpower of either kind. And he says that the counterpower can either be anti-power, which is what the oppressor prefers, because he can trace it and destroy it, Galtung says. But counterpower in the form of autonomy is more difficult to destroy because it is much more located inside the mind of the person and the culture of the nation or of the institution, perhaps even an international criminal jurisdiction. Nietzsche had his clear moments when he worked on his notes on Will to Power in the 1880s, which were published after his death under the title Der Wille zur Macht, The Will to Power. He said, a little fresh air, this absurd condition of Europe shall not go on much longer. Is there any idea at all behind this bovine nationalism? What value can there be now when everything points to a wider and more common interests? In encouraging this boorish self-conceit, and he continues, inexorably, hesitantly, terrible as fate, he's pumping up the expectation as to what is going to come when he uses this language of jaw and teeth. The great task in question is approaching. How shall the earth as a whole be governed? And to what end shall man as a whole and no longer as a people, a race, be raised and trained? And these wider perspectives are echoed by Russell. There is no hope for the world unless power can be tamed and brought into the service, not of this or that group of fanatical tyrants, but of the whole human race. If social life is to satisfy social desires, it must be based on some philosophy, not derived from the love of power. Love of power, if it is to be beneficent, must be bound up with some end other than power. I mean that the desire for some other end must be so strong that power is unsatisfying unless it ministers to this end. Russell says that the period of naked power is short, it's brief, and it usually comes to an end in one of three ways, the second of which is the, quote, establishment of a stable dictatorship, which soon becomes traditional. Of this, the most notable instance is the empire of Augustus. And that brings us to the symbol that you have in your program and that we have on the project banner, namely the image of Octavian, Emperor Augustus. Octavian called himself the first citizen of the state and created the first face of the Roman Empire. His reign started Pax Romana, which provided more or less peace within the Roman Empire for as much as 200 years, and he laid the foundations of a regime that lasted it in one form or another for almost 1,500 years through the ultimate decline of the Western Roman Empire and until the fall of Constantinople in 1453. But he had critics, and Tacitus in the Annals said, in actual fact, the motive of Octavian, the future Augustus, was lust for power. There had certainly been peace, but it was a blood-stained peace of disasters and assassinations. Let us introduce Octavian to the fresco of Bernardino Pochetti, which we have at the end of the hall we are in. He was a contemporary of King Herod and Mary and her son Jesus. King Herod ruled Judea under Octavian, and Mary was a Jewish citizen of Judea and ultimately of the Roman world. Mary beckons with her hand, and Octavian raises his hand in an imperial greeting in these images. Octavian had his domain of blood-stained lust for power with killings and wars. He filled the role of King Herod, if you like, in Pochetti's fresco. But he was also the ultimate institution builder, institution that provided for rule of some law and order and peace. He was the builder of good institutions. He filled the role of Cosimo II, the Medici, in the fresco. And after he died, he was deified and was elevated to the third dimension of the fresco. The cult of Divus Augustus existed in Rome until Christianity became the state religion in the year 391. But why do we use the image of Octavian in this project, the image you see here? It is an image of the ultimate power, the purest distilled power, almost absolute power of a benevolent dictator. But it has two black holes where the eyes should be. It is a mosque. And as such, it reminds us of the need to unmask power. And that brings me to my six conclusions. First, Russell is right when he writes that we must judge the exercise of power by its effects. Secondly, against this measure, we can also say that his calls for a science of power and an ethics of power are both highly pertinent to international criminal justice. Thirdly, power in international criminal justice needs to be unmasked to a greater extent than what has so far been done, but in a responsible, constructive manner. Four, we need a sub-discipline of sociology of international criminal justice. And we hope that this project can make a contribution towards its crystallization. Five, international justice institutions need better mirrors in which they can see and understand themselves more accurately. The oversight of international criminal justice institutions cannot be left to states' parties alone, many of whom are reluctant to criticize the ICC as long as powerful states remain outside and skeptical. We need a sociology of international criminal justice. We need investigative journalism. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.